Pure Dog Talk is the podcast on purebred dogs. We talk to the legends in the sport and give you tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Pure Dog Talk is sponsored by ChampionshipBreeders.com. Championship Breeders is a proud supporter of the American Kennel Club, our specialty and all breed clubs, our dog sports, and the gifts of therapy and service from our canine companions. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I am your host, Laura Reeves, and I am very excited today to be joined by one of our preeminent judges in the sport, Eugene Blake, and he has a pretty fascinating story I think you guys are going to enjoy. So, Mr. Blake, son of a Louisiana sharecropper.
Well, my father was a sharecropper back in the Depression, mm-hmm. back in the early 30s and mm-hmm. 40s.
And your first involvement, really, with dogs was with your dad training bird dogs.
Well, yeah, my father used to train gun dogs back mm-hmm. in the Depression. I mean, he's down in Louisiana. I mean, we had a lot of very wealthy people down there that did a lot of quail hunting. Mm-hmm. And so my father did everything he could to make a buck, so mm-hmm. he started training gun dogs. And he trained gun dogs from about 1932 until about 1941.
Wow. And you got to go with him sometimes?
All the time. I was born in 1936. Right. My father picked up a gun or a fishing pole. I was right in his footsteps. I was always a daddy's boy. I mean, I love the outdoors, and it's stuck with me to this day. Right. I mean, I love the hunting and fish. I don't do much hunting, but I do a lot of fishing, but I don't do much hunting because I don't care anything about killing. I care about seeing the dogs work. I have four beagles that I have now that a friend of mine's keep up in the country for me, and I take them out and chase the bunny around, and I have more fun doing that than you can shake a stick at.
Yeah, and I think that informs a lot of your judging today too, that background, that knowledge, working with dogs.
Well, I've always loved animals. As I said, I grew up in the country and we always had animals. I mean, really, as I said, my father always had hunting dogs, mm-hmm. and they ran loose in the country, and we would wake up in the morning and sometimes 10, 12 puppies crawl out from underneath the house, and we had puppies that we took care of and stuff like that. And I get into my show career, and to some degree to that, I mean, it was very hard for me when I first started in dogs to see dogs in crate, because it was very, very painful to me to see dogs in crate. I used to really literally sit and cry, and I'm 19 years old, with these dogs in crates, because I wasn't used to that. I felt like they was in jail. But I got used to it, and sometimes it bothers me now to see dogs in crates when people don't take care of them like they should. So, but anyway, that's another story.
That's okay. So another thing that I thought was really remarkable, and I think is a good teaching moment for some of our young people growing up, is reading about you working how many jobs? Two jobs, three jobs at a time. And that work ethic.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I got out of school in 1951. But let me give you a little background first. I mean, as I said, I was born in 1936. In 1941, we moved to Houston from Shreveport. Mm-hmm. And we stayed there because my father realized that he couldn't really make a living for his family, and I'm from a big family in Louisiana, so we moved to Houston. We lived in Houston from 1941 until 1946, after World War mm-hmm. II. So, because the houses that we was living in, they sold them to GIs when they came home from the war. Mm-hmm. So my father couldn't find a home quick enough for us to live in, so we moved back to Louisiana, and that was mm-hmm. in 1946. And then my father, he did a lot of work for us. He worked on a pipeline, mm-hmm. and actually, my father was a cook. He was actually, when he passed away at 64, he was a gourmet cook.
Wow.
And he did a lot of things in the meantime. He was a longshoreman when he was in Houston between 41 and 46. He was a longshoreman down on waterfront. Oh. And as I said, we moved back to Louisiana in 46. So we stayed there, and that's when he was doing some sharecropping there from 47, 48, 49. And in 50, a sad thing happened. My mother and my father got a divorce. And my mother lived and stayed in Shreveport, but my father came back to Houston, and I came back to Houston with him. And there, I mean, I went on with my schooling there, and I stayed with him. And then I got my first job working on a construction job of all things. And what am I, 15?
Right.
And I could not handle it. I worked there 2 weeks, and that was the end of that. Then on my second job, I went worked at a gas station pumping gas. Mm-hmm. And that didn't work too well because the gas, I got very sensitive and nose, and I was high all the time smelling gas and stuff like that, so I didn't do that. And so from there, as I said, my father started cooking, and then I got a busboy job at the restaurant where my father's worked at. And I did that for maybe 2 years. And in 1954, I started working at a drugstore delivering drugs. Back in those days, the doctors would call the pharmacist, and the pharmacist would take the prescription and fill it, and then we would deliver the drugs to the patient, stuff like that. So I did that, and it was two of us working there. This was Avalon Drugstore in Houston, Texas. So I did that, and we would split shift. I would work days 1 week and nights the next week. So this other guy that worked there, he wanted to work days only. So he knew if he get me a job that he could work days only. So he asked me one day, he said, "Gene, would you like to have a part-time job?" And I said, "Well, yeah." He said, because, I mean, I didn't have nothing to do and nothing like that, but I was never one to run with a big crowd. I was mostly older than most of the college guys I went ran around with and stuff like that. So he said, "I know someone needs someone to raise dogs at a grooming shop." And say, "You ain't got to like dogs. All you got to do is pretend you like dogs because they really need somebody." And stuff like that. And I said, "Well, I like dogs, but I ain't never seen a purebred poodle in my life." So anyway, so I went over to their French poodle shop, and was owned by Hazel Ham, and I applied for the job, and she gave me a job working at this French poodle shop. And the French poodle shop was in a house where her mother and father lived, mom and pop. They lived there, and they lived in the back, and Hazel had the grooming shop in the front. So I still worked there from 8 to 12, and I worked there from about March until about September. And Hazel saw my interest in dogs because anytime I got a delivery going over that way, I would go over that way and see the dogs when they was finished. Because when the dog come in the morning, I saw them scrubby and stuff like that, and people didn't take care of the dogs like they should have. And Hazel would rough the dogs in, and there was a young man by the name of Jimmy Andrews, who was a great trimmer, and he was still in school. So Hazel would rough the dogs in, and when Jimmy got out of school, he would come in and he would do the scissor work and stuff on him like that. So, and as say, Hazel saw my interest in it, so she asked me one day, she said, "Gene, do you think you could do this?" And I said, "Yeah, I think I could do that, really." And so she said, "Well, when I get a standard come in, I'll let you try. Standard is the best to learn on because they're big feet of bigger and stuff like that." So I did the feet on this dog. His name was Pierre Cape. I will remember him from the day I die. It was the first dog I ever trimmed. So I trimmed his feet. Hazel, you know, I did a decent job thinking about on what I know now and what I did then. And so I didn't get a chance to groom her anymore, but I would still go over there. So then this next, a miniature come in. Her name was Fifi. And she came in, and I did her feet, and Hazel praised me and told me I did a good job, stuff like that. And what I would do is I would do that between, I was not working at the time. I would be between 12 and about 10 minutes to 2 when I went to work at the drugstore. I would stay there and do that and learn how to do that this time. Back there by myself. Well, nobody there with me because I had saw her do it. And I have a photogenic mind. If I see somebody do something, I can learn how to do it better than you can tell me how to do it.
Right.
So anyway, so I would do that until about 10 minutes to 2. I would run over to the drugstore, and every time I got the delivery back over that way, I would come over there and see the dog finish. When Jimmy came in after school, he got out about 2 o'clock, and I would see the finished dog. So anyway, I did that, and I was doing Fifi, and I did a face, and she said, "Jane, you can do a little bit more," and I did a face. And back in the 50s, most of the poodles had tassels on the ears, like a Bellington. And so I did the ear, and not look quite close enough what Hazel had done. I mean, she went with the grain, and I went with the grain, but I went against the grain on the ear. And I cut this dog's ear right in the flea pocket right here, and I nicked this dog's ear.
I've done it.
And listen, I'm going to tell you, I mean, when I was in school, we went to the hospital to see, because I really would like to have been a doctor, but I couldn't stand blood. And so when I seen this dog ear bleeding, I'm yelling and screaming, Hazel, when I was 18, Hazel come in, "Gene, what's wrong with it? I'm going to cut this dog's ear off." So, and it wasn't bad, but it looked bad because of the slit that's already in the ear. So Hazel come in and, you know, squeezed it a little bit and took some ice and put on it and stopped the bleeding and stuff like that. And I'm crying and all this stuff. And I want to take the dog to the vet. And so she said, "Oh, Gene, it's okay. Don't worry about it. I want to take the dog to the vet." So right next door to the drugstore was a veterinarian clinic where Hazel used to have a grooming shop. And the doctors over there were Dr. Slay and McDonald. That was their names. And so I took off and took the dog to the vet. And Hazel told me to call them and told them I was on my way. So I took them over there. They had to scuffle to get two stitches in. It really wasn't bad. And that was about September. So anyway, I quit the poodle shop. I could not handle doing that. I mean, it really just bothered me. So that was about September. And about Halloween, Thanksgiving, Hazel and Jimmy came over to the drugstore. Mm-hmm. And in the drugstore there, they had a fountain where mm-hmm. everybody had, most of the drugstores back in those days had a fountain there where they had made sandwiches and sodas and stuff like that. Nick just came over for lunch, and we really didn't talk about dogs and nothing like that. So when they went back to the shop, Jimmy called and offered me a job. And I said, doing what? And he said, grooming dogs. He said, I said, no, I can't do that. I can't do that. So I didn't think I could do it. So Hazel had met my father, mm-hmm. and she talked to my father, mm-hmm. and she talked to Mr. Northrup. He owned the drugstore, mm-hmm. and she was a friend of his because she had the business right next to him when mm-hmm. she had the business at the veterinary clinic. She talked to him. And Mr. Northrup talked to me, and he told me that Hazel thought I could do it, and Jimmy thought I could do it, and that there was no future. He would hate to lose me as an employee, but there was no future in right. driving a truck at the drugstore. And so he told me he thought I should do it, and my father, he talked to me, and that was in November. And I gave him a 2 weeks' notice, and I went to work at the French Cruise Shop January the 4th in 1955, full-time. But let me back up.
And here we are today.
Let me back up and put one little additive in that. You know Denny Mouse, right?
Yes.
Okay, Denny Mouse lived in River Oaks.
Yes.
Which was right around the corner where the drugstore were. Denny Mouse used to go to the theater. And she would go there, and Denny was adopted. And so she would go to the movie and spend all her money on popcorn and stuff like that and call the maid to come pick her up. And so she went and go pick her up. So she told her to come pick me up. She said, call out the drugstore and get that boy down there to bring you up there. So I would go down to the theater and pick her up and put her in the back of the truck. And you stay down back there. This is 1955.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, so when you see Denny, talk to
her. I'll have to ask her about that.
She'll tell you about that.
So I think that one of the things I think is interesting is so many people associate you with sighthounds, obviously mm-hmm. Salukis, Afghans, etc. Mm-hmm. But I love the poodle connection. Mm-hmm. And you spent time with Maxine Bean.
Well, actually, a lot of people connect me with sighthounds. But see, you got to realize I started in poodles.
Mm-hmm.
My first dog I owned, purebred dog I owned, was a poodle.
Mm-hmm.
Then a whippet, a pointer, cockers.
And cockers, Norm Austin.
Well, see, cockers. Okay, well, see, Norman Austin was a real good friend of Hazel Ham, and he showed cockers for the Levees in Houston. And Maria and Otto Wazels, who owns Lock Lane Kennel, they was my transportation to going to dog shows.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. See, Norman was a real good friend with them, and so Norman was a great breeder, a great handler, but a lousy trimmer. And so I used to trim his poodle for him. He bred some beautiful, wonderful poodles. He taught me how to trim cockers, show trims and stuff like that. And I used to trim his poodles and stuff like that. And he was my mentor. I mean, he was one of my first person on the road mentor for his show dog concern. Jimmy did too, don't get me wrong. Jimmy is the reason why I'm here talking to you. Without Jimmy, I would not be, because he was a great trimmer and he was a lousy handler. I mean, he was a great trimmer, but he just gets so involved with his dog that I have seen him walk through a ring looking at his dog. I mean, but anyway, that's another story. But no, I learned a lot from Norman. He was one of my mentors, but I had other great mentors too. I mean, you take like Harry Sangster. I don't want to go name dropping here, but Harry Sangster, I mean, he told me, he said, boy, if I was good as you, I would charge $25 a toenail just to cut toenails. I mean, he was really, Harry Sangster is someone who, you know, yep. Corky worked for and stuff yep. like that. And all the handlers, when they came on the Texas circuit, I mean, I would sit at ringside and listen, I would go to the dog show at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I would leave the dog show at 7 o'clock at night when it was over, because I stayed there until the last dog. That was the one thing that was very confusing to me at the dog show. When I went to my first dog show, as I said, it was bad for me watching the dogs in crates, but it was also bad for me to see one person standing in the middle of the ring and saying that was the best dog in the show. And that was hard for me to understand. And so for that reason, I started learning what it took for that person to learn to say that he had the knowledge, rather, that was the best dog in the show. Right. And I started studying pedigrees, mm-hmm. and I used to really a lot of pedigrees. I used to read pedigrees and stuff like that and try to learn as much as I could by dog. But he was one of my mentors. But from the standpoint of Maxine Bean showed a lot of boxes, a lot of cockers and poodles. Mm-hmm. And I used to help all the handlers. I mean, right. whenever they win, I would take the winner back in the ring. Frank Sabella, for instance, I'm not name dropping it, I said. Frank Sabella used to come on the Texas circuit, and he would win the non-sporting group, he would win the touring group, and he sometimes would win the working group with Derek Rain Corgi right. when he was in the working right. group. And I would always, I mean, like if they were busy in a ring, he would tell me to put his dog together to go in a group or something like that when Mike Shea worked for him and Donna Rogers worked for him and a lot of people, Timmy and all these people right. worked for him. But I had so many people that I could learn from right. and I could not get enough knowledge in my head and I would help anybody, I mean, at any time. And right. so that was right. a lot of my upbringing in dog.
Definitely. Definitely you had a good support system down there.
Right. And not only that, I mean, and we get into, as a handler, I started in 55. I judged my first match in 1957. Mm-hmm. My camp won the match with a dachshund.
Anyway, I love it.
But as I said, I had mentors in regards to judges. I mean, mm-hmm. like when I started showing dogs, we had such great judge mentors because they right. would tell us when we were showing a bad dog.
Right.
And we would learn because, as I said, I mean, we had a dog that it was showy, pretty coat, sound. We thought it was a winner. And right. wherever the judges would teach us more, like Langdon Scott or Bigasso, Major Gasso, Eldred Gamble, Glenn Summers, I mean, Bob Waters. I mean, I can go on and on about judges that really taught us about dogs, where right now, and this is today.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask. Where did we go wrong here?
Well, where we are today is that most of the people, to me, and I'm not downing it, don't get me wrong, but most people that have a comb, a brush, and a lead is a handler. And I really think it's sad that most of them think they know it all. I'm not criticizing them or something like that. If you say something to them, they think that you know it all to the point that you can't do anything to help anyone because they know it all. A little incident, I judged in November in Connecticut. I had a young man in the ring showing a French Bulldog. He was feeding his dog the whole time I'm trying to go over it. I say, sir, if you just hold the dog head, I can go over the dog, it take me a second, and then it's over and done with. He put the dog down. I never asked an exhibitor down and back. I'll tell him to the corner and back. You is a salesman. I'm a buyer. You got to sell me what you want me to buy. So I told him to go to the corner and back. He went about halfway down and back. I said, sir, please, to the corner and back. He said, all the way? I said, yes, to the corner and back. Okay, he pointed the corner and back, and I asked him, I said, and right around the ring to the end. So he went around the ring. These rings have mats. He went halfway around the ring and cut across the ring and went round into the numbers. I didn't correct him then, have him go all the way around the ring. So anyway, so I went on and judged him. He went second in his class. Miss Gail Scott in the class with him, and she won the class. So then after I finished judging French Bulldog, that was the last breed in that hour time. So I was there doing some paperwork, that getting ready for my next breed. And he was standing at my ring entrance like he wanted to talk to me. And I said, please, come on in my office here. He said, can I come in your ring? I said, sure, come in the office here. And anyway, I do it for a couple of reasons, because of the fact that my ring steward is there, they can hear the conversations yes. being said and stuff like that. So anyway, so he come in and he said, well, he didn't understand why I chastised him in the way he showed his dog, but I didn't chastise Michelle Scott. And I said, sir, I didn't chastise you for showing your dog. I said, I was trying to do my job and have you to do your job so I could do my job. I said, for instance, like I had you to go to the corner and back, you went halfway down and back. I said, I had you to go around the ring, you went across the ring and back. But see, back in those days, if a judge would have said something to us about what something was wrong, we're going to listen. Listen, I mean, most handlers move the dog too fast. Most judges tell you, slow down. Langdon Scott. I go on.
Annie Clark used to yell.
Who?
Annie Clark.
Oh, Annie. Listen, you can go on. One of the worst ones, J.D. Jones. J.D. No. Jones. He would almost want you at a walk.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the thing about it is this. I mean, most exhibitors today don't listen to instruction. And that's very important, in my opinion, because of the fact that I'm trying to help them. I mean, I have one agenda. Find the best dog in the ring against the competition, and that's my winner. I will do that until they put me in the furnace. But
so one of the things that, and this actually, you just basically answered several of my questions simultaneously. The first thing, you've got a lineup of dogs. Mm-hmm. Any breed, pick a breed. What is the first thing that's going to catch your eye?
Well, let me explain to you. I judge dogs in like a 5 area category. all dogs. When I walk in that ring, I know what I'm looking at and what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is, like, to me, the most important thing in a dog is breed type. Without breed type, you don't have a breed. The second most important thing to me is balance. Balance is part of breed type to make that dog what it's supposed to be. The third most important thing to me is temperament. Mm-hmm. And I see temperament for that breed. And the fourth most important thing to me is movement. And the fifth most important thing to me is timing. And a lot of people don't understand what I mean by timing. Timing is something like if his car is not in time, it's not going to run right. If your heart is not clicking right, you're not going to walk right. That is very important for that dog to function to be the breed it's supposed to be. That is the most important thing to me. The one thing is this. I judge every dog to the standard. The standard is what I'm judging that dog to. And I'm going to get into a little area here that some people are going to disagree with me and very few people will, in my opinion. To me, there's three stages of this dog game. There's a breeder, and it's the welcome box. There's a confirmation ring, and that is dog that compete against each other, become a champion. And then there's this dog out here. It's a performance dog, to be a field dog, coursing dog, a bird dog, or whatever. Okay, this breeder, in my opinion, should have agenda of breeding a dog that fit that standard to go in the ring and compete against that dog to become a champion. Mm-hmm. Okay, to me, that dog is the most important thing for his confirmation is concerned. He's come in the ring and compete against his competition to become a champion, fitting in that standard. Mm-hmm. Okay? I do not take anything away from that standard, nor do I put anything in that standard. I'm going to follow that standard to the T, really. Now, and what I mean by that is, I have a real big thing about tails. If a standard calls for a dock tail, it's supposed to be a dock or shouldn't be in my ring. To me, that is part of breed type for that dog. Mm-hmm. With that being said, I judge all over the world. I judge dog with long tail. I don't have no problem with FCI standard in regards to long tail. I have a problem with the people who bring that dog from an FCI country here and it's short in our country to our standard, where our standard is different than that standard. Just like when I go to other countries, I'm not going to go over there and penalize that dog with that long tail because of the fact it's allowed there. Mm-hmm. This is America and this is the standard. And then a lot of people ask, okay, who owns the standard? The country of origin or the country that the dogs are shown in? To me, I think it's the country of the dog is shown in, not the country of origin, because they're not shown in the country of origin. Right. If they go to the country of origin, then they're shown there. But anyway, color, size, I mean, we're going to disqualification in regards to weight and size right. and stuff like that in some breed. Right. But to me, I've judged the dog to the standard. Like I had an incident today where I excused a dog from the ring with a long tail, a poodle, and I think I'm going to go down and talk to another breeder, I think, about it. Mm-hmm. But my thing is this. That standard is there for me to follow and not to add or take away from it. I'm going to tell you something. As a breeder, if a judge didn't judge the dog to my standard, I would not show to him because he's not respecting my standard. He passed that test to judge that dog to that standard, and that's what I think he should follow. And he should not add or take away anything from it.
Yeah, I think that's good. And I think you, again, touched on another issue that I wanted to get to right there. So apparently you can read my mind. So
okay.
Final question. I ask this to everybody. What's your best suggestion? Pick one. Your best suggestion for growing the sport going forward. A lot's changed. We know that. So how do we keep that vibrancy? How do we keep that excitement? How do we grow the sport going forward?
I don't know how we can grow it. I think that the AKC trying to do a lot of things to keep this sport going. For instance, like I was talking to someone just a little while ago, they were saying they didn't like Reserve Best in Show for Juniors. They didn't like Reserve Best in Show at the Dog Show. And I say those are the two things, and not so much a Reserve Best in Show for Juniors, but Reserve Best in Show for the Dog Show has really have kept this afloat. I mean, other ways, like she was complaining, but she was saying it's too much with the best bred by and the best owner handler. Hey, that's what's keeping this dog game afloat. We need that. I mean, like these shows here, this is the first time they have had four shows here, and it's keeping it afloat. You have to do things to keep it afloat. What to keep it for? I don't know. I can say this. My personal opinion, from whatever it's worth, the 4-6 is not a good thing. It's not something that it's no way I would take my 4-month-old puppy to a dog show. Personally, I think that puppy matches is the greatest thing for dog shows. Listen, when I was in Houston, I had a training class. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have training classes. At Cirrus and Wilbrook, when it closed at 9 o'clock, we would train dogs from 9 o'clock to 11 o'clock at night. We would have 100 to 150 dogs there being trained from around the neighborhood and stuff like that.
Wow.
It got so big that when they built Shopstown Shopping Center, we moved to Shopstown Shopping Center. And Adeline Pardo and Bobby Peebles and Jimmy Andrews, we all had training classes there. And Mike Kemp later on come in and help us and stuff like that. Adeline Pardo, I mean, she was really big in that because she was an obedient trainer.
Mm-hmm.
Maureen Peach, she lived there, and she would help and stuff like that. But Sid Sims would come out. He would not help us too much. He was a dachshund breeder there in Houston. But puppy match is a really good thing because it get the neighborhood involved. And that's where the younger generation, we don't have younger generation coming up, dog generation. Like a lot of the older people are 2 and 3 generation of dog people. I'm not. I'm a one generation because my parents was not in dog before me. But I really don't know the answer to that. But I would say puppy matches is a great thing. And you take, like, for instance, like, I'm borderline right now of stopped doing juniors because of the fact that I don't think that I can do anything to help them. And I really wish I could reach out to them to help them. I mean, because the younger generation is what's going to keep the sport alive. I mean, otherwise, like, we got so many people like myself that is over the hill to some degree for as how much longer we're going to be here.
Right.
But we need somebody, the younger generation, come on. So how are we going to get them involved? Social media is one of the things that's hurting the dog game in regards to younger generation, stuff like that. And I'm going to tell you something. I excused an exhibitor from the ring for talking on the phone in the ring. I went over to her and I asked her, I said, ma'am, I said, is that an emergency? She said, no. She said, I'm just talking to my friend. I said, well, you may be excused. I said, if it's important for you to talk to your friend, you can go outside the ring and then talk to your friend. Really. And to me, this is what the social media is all about. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm not downing it because it's the way of life. But to answer the question, I really don't know. I wish that kennel clubs could get more into having puppy matches.
Fun matches and stuff.
Fun matches and stuff like that. I mean, really, you would see if you can get more peoples and, and do a leopard. The other thing is this. I mean, I know it costs money and stuff like that, but if the kennel club would try to do a little bit more in doing a little publication of the dog show before the dog show, I mean, like, I don't know what it costs to put a, I mean, they may know somebody that could announce on the radio or on the TV or something like that. When I was in Houston, I used to have a little TV show. Once a month, I would go to Channel 13 and I would have a breed that I would talk about that breed. It wasn't the 5 minutes that I was there, but like when Duke the Palm won the group at the Garden, I took him there. Apollo, I had him there. I had to take one of my dogs there, but I would take him there. And that put the community.
Yeah.
But I think it would do a little bit more advertising of the dog show because a lot of people don't know the dog show is going on.
Right.
And so I think if we could do that, get people out. How many spectators you get out to a dog show that never have heard of the dog show that may get interested in it? Right. I don't know. As I said, I think that we need to try to get the community more involved.
Yeah.
I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. Well, Gene, I think you have to judge best in show this evening.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you so much for joining us on Pure Dog Talk. I sure appreciate it.
I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope it's something that the fancy can really get some.
I think you had a lot of really good wise words and a lot of lot of history in the sport. So.
And one thing is this. Listen, if I can do something or say something, help somebody, it makes me feel good. Believe me. I mean, I'm a person like this. A long time ago, I was so serious in doing what I did that everybody used to come up to me and say, Gene, smile. And I say, I'm smiling. I'm going to say, I'm going to put a sign around my neck saying, I'm smiling. I say, what if I come up to you and tell you, stop smiling? But I'm always smiling. I'm a person like this. I mean, I like to help people if I can. And if I can help someone, please come up to me and believe me. You take like Maxine Beam, for instance. Maxine Beam was a workaholic and stuff like that. And Maxine had her work to do, and somebody go up and talk to her, and she would act like she ignored him, but she's not. She got her work to do. And you go up to her, Maxine, one of the sweetest lady that you ever wanted to see, but a lot of people thought she was grumpy because of the fact that she had her work to do, and she did her work, and she did a great job at it.
Thank you so much, Gene.
Appreciate it.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. This will help share the love with others out there in the sport. This has been Pure Dog Talk with your host, Laura Reeves. We hope you can join us next time as we continue on the journey to success with your purebred dog.